All right. Well, good evening, everyone. Nice to see everyone back again for the third week of this course. And thanks very much to Lee for inviting me to say some words this week. So we're carrying on, obviously, with our series of sessions on contemplation practice. And I thought I might start by just saying a few words about how I found contemplation practice to be useful and suggest some ways that you might like to play with it in the future. First of all, why do it at all? Well, there are three types of wisdom, you might say. There's the type of wisdom that comes from hearing something. And this is the kind of thing that's secondhand. It's easily challenged. It's the kind of wisdom that I often find myself in possession of when I hear something really interesting on a podcast, and then I go to tell my partner about it. And I say, "Hey, I heard this really cool thing, and it's this, and it's this, and it's this." And she looks at me and says, "Well, that's stupid, because what about this, and this, and this, and this?" And I think, "Oh, hadn't thought about that." And what I rapidly discover in those moments is that this is not my knowledge. This is someone else's knowledge that I'm just uncritically repeating. And I haven't thought it through. I can't defend it when it's criticized. Yeah, it's all well and good, but it's really just something that I've heard. The second kind of wisdom is the wisdom that comes from thinking about something. So I hear something on a podcast and then I spend a while thinking about it and I figure out how it works. Maybe I read a bit more about it and I see some of the arguments for and against and work it through in my mind. Now, at this point, this is a much more kind of sort of complete sort of knowledge because it's something that I've at least worked my way through now on a practical level. And if people ask questions, then maybe I can answer them and I can defend the point of view that it's trying to articulate and that sort of thing. So if someone says, "Well, what about this?" I might say, "Well, the general idea is that it works like this and this and this." The problem with that, though, is that there's a risk that knowledge that stops at the level of thinking becomes a kind of intellectual trophy for the trophy case of clever thoughts that I have had, clever thoughts that I've thought my way through, things I understand, things I know about. And very often I'll find that things I understand at this level, I can explain, I can articulate, I can talk about them till I'm blue in the face. Give me half a chance, I can do that. But it doesn't express itself in my life in any meaningful way, except when I'm yammering on about it. It doesn't affect the way I make decisions. It doesn't affect the way I see the world. It's something that I've thought about, but it's not really part of me yet. It's not really practically useful. So the third kind of wisdom is the wisdom that comes from experiencing. And that can come from meditation, it can come from contemplation, it can come from various sources. But the point here is that this is wisdom that has actually become part of us. It's become part of how we see the world. It's become real to us. It's integrated into who we are. And Buddhist wisdom is really only fully useful when it reaches this third stage, when it's actually integrated into the way we see the world, the way we make decisions, the way we conduct ourselves in the course of our lives. So contemplation can certainly help with the thinking stage because we take a teaching and we've heard about it, but then we actively sit down and we think about it, right? That's the contemplation practice. We pick a topic and we think about it a bunch. So it can certainly take us to the point of having fully thought through a topic and be able to articulate it and defend it and so on. But I would certainly say, maybe this is my Zen showing. We don't talk about my Zen side, but I would say that that's not taking it far enough. Really, you don't want to stop at the point where you just understand a Buddhist topic to the point that you can explain it to someone else. You want to keep going until it becomes real, until it becomes part of you. And a key part of that is that this practice isn't about learning the right answers. It's not about being able to recite the doctrine. It's not a sort of Buddhist catechism where we learn the right answers to the questions. This practice is about exploring the teachings for ourselves, testing, challenging, questioning. What does this actually mean? Do I even believe this? What happens if I poke and prod it? What happens if I take a critical lens to it? What happens if I examine it in every way I can think of? Does it still hold up? And at a certain point, if you keep going with that, then it will make that shift and it will become something that's real to you. It's not just something that you've learned, but it's something that you've explored deeply enough that it starts to become actually meaningful. So with that in mind, we can see contemplation as another approach to Buddhist practice. Yeah, the sort of minimum takeaway from this course is that you come away with 4 new guided practices, right? Lee guides 3 of them, I guide 1 of them, and you've got 4 recordings that you can play again at some point in the future. But I would say it's more useful to take away from this course an approach to practice, a framework that you can bring to really any Dharma topic. A way of digging into something and really getting your teeth into it, really exploring it thoroughly. It's particularly good, I've found, for topics that don't make that much sense at first. So Lee's going to talk next week about dependent origination, which is a good one. And I'm going to talk tonight about the 5 aggregates. Because, yeah, the first time I encountered the 5 aggregates, I was like, that's a weird list. Well, moving on. I could see the point of a lot of the other teachings, but the 5 aggregates, I don't know. So what are the 5 aggregates? Well, there's a bunch of different ways to look at the 5 aggregates. There's a bunch of different ways to understand them. But one way we can look at them is as a framework for carving up our experience, our subjective experience, into these 5 buckets or 5 heaps, 5 aggregates, 5 khandhas. And actually, although the list can come across as kind of arbitrary at first, it's quite an important one. What's traditionally thought to be the Buddha's 2nd discourse on not-self is actually a contemplation of the 5 aggregates. It's an examination of the self in terms of the aggregates. I was slightly embarrassed this afternoon when I went back to reread that sutta. I actually thought I'd come up with this contemplation myself, and then I reread the discourse and was like, oh, that's where I got it from. So what we're going to do tonight is essentially a version of the Buddha's contemplation of the self in terms of the aggregates that I've kind of fleshed out a little bit and translated into language that I find a bit more accessible. The discourse invites us to look at each of the aggregates in terms of various characteristics. For one, there's lack of control over them. So the first aggregate, for example, is form, material form. This body is probably the aspect of form that we consider to be ourself. And the Buddha says, well, can you say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus? Can I just decide, you know what, I've got a headache now, I'm just not going to have a headache anymore? Well, that's never worked for me. So how much control do we really have over this body? We obviously have some degree of control, because if I want to raise my arm up, look, check it out, I can do that. But can I control every aspect of it? Can I just spontaneously shed those extra pounds that I've been carrying around since Christmas? Oh, I wish I could. It doesn't really work like that, does it? Another lens to look at is impermanence. Is this body permanent or impermanent? I went to the optician the other week and I can assure you it's impermanent. Unsatisfactoriness. Is this thing pleasant or unpleasant? Is what is impermanent a reliable source of happiness? Is it something dependable? Is it something that we can plant a flag in and say, yeah, this is it. This is my source of happiness when it's an impermanent thing, when the sands are shifting beneath our feet? And the Buddha concludes that if something is beyond our control, impermanent, unsatisfactory, unreliable, is it really worth considering to be myself? Is it the thing that we want to hang our hat on? Is it the thing that we want to depend on? So, as I say, I've fleshed out the contemplation a little bit for us tonight. And one of the things I found interesting to do is to examine the kinds of senses, plural, of self that we sort of extrapolate from each aggregate. What do I mean by that? Well, let's first of all take a look at what the aggregates are, and then as we're going through, I'll talk about what I mean by extrapolating a sense of self from the aggregates. So first of all, what are they? What are the five aggregates? As I say, they're categories of experience. First one is rupa, materiality. physical forms, and in the case of the self, it's this thing here, this body, the thing inside the skin bag, as one of my teachers describes it. So the body is pretty key to our identity, right? It's the thing that when we see it in a mirror, we say, oh, that's me. It's the thing that, in fact, was so large on my screen just now that I had to spend a while hunting for the button to make my face not be giant in the screen, because I don't want to be looking at a giant copy of my own form all night. So the body is quite important. We can identify quite strongly with the body. Sometimes its appearance, sometimes its capabilities, its characteristics. Maybe we think of ourselves as a sporty person or an attractive person, or maybe a disabled person, something like that. Aspects of our body clearly have a strong impact on how we are in the world, what we're able to do, how people relate to us. And so it's very easy to attach to aspects of those physical characteristics and think of ourselves in those terms. The second aggregate is Vedana. And we can translate that in a number of ways. Valence is one of Lee's favorites. I tend to think of it as sort of pleasantness, as a shorthand for pleasantness, unpleasantness, and somewhere in betweenness, but that's a bit ungainly. But essentially, Vedana is the aspect of experience that tells us sort of how it feels. Is it nice? Is it nasty? Or is it just kind of, somewhere in between? So obviously, experiences that show up to us present themselves as being pleasant, unpleasant, or kind of neutral. What does that have to do with a sense of self? Well, as time goes on, we start to learn the things that we like, the things that we dislike, the things that are pleasant, the things that are unpleasant. We extrapolate our preferences from that. And we can attach to those. I am the sort of person who likes jazz music. I am the sort of person who doesn't like, I don't know, getting drenched by an inconsiderate driver going through a puddle, that kind of thing. And, you know, some of these things are we consider to be a matter of taste. For example, there are two kinds of people in the world. There are people who don't like the taste of aniseed, and then there are people who are wrong. Some of these preferences we tend to see more as objective facts, and that can really get us into trouble. So preferences are kind of important, again, to our sense of who we are. That's something else worth looking at. Aggregate number three is Sanya, usually translated perception, maybe conceptualization, labeling. It's our sense of what things are. So if I hold this up, maybe you can see it's a water bottle. We see the object and we just recognize it as a water bottle because we know what water bottles are. We've seen them before. We have a mental label that applies to the thing as we see in the world. And we say, oh yeah, water bottle. I know what that is. And there's maybe some things hanging off that concept like, yeah, you can put water in it. But basically the identifying the object is the key to this. Now, here you might think, well, how are you going to get a sense of self out of that? Because surely, you know, it certainly looks like we see the world objectively, right? Like anybody who knows what a water bottle is will correctly identify this as a water bottle. It's not really up for grabs. But when you start to look at it, actually, we all carry around a different set of concepts with ourselves. For example, to some people, a particular object might be a guitar. To other people, it might be a 1958 Gibson Les Paul, which is an entirely different beast. It's not just a guitar, not just any old guitar. Insert your favorite analogy for cars or whatever else. So the more you know about a subject, the more refined your concepts are, and probably the more concepts you have. You start getting into whether Gibson guitars or Fender guitars are better. You start getting into whether you prefer single coil pickups or humbuckers, and whether they're passive or active, all this kind of, and probably 90% feel like, what the heck is this guy even talking about now? Because I've now moved to a level of concept that is just completely irrelevant to any normal person's life, unless you're super into guitars. But trust me, if you're as into guitars as I am, these things really matter. So I see a world of very nuanced guitars, and maybe some of you just see a world of these kind of planks of wood with strings attached that make that noise. Another interesting one is some people have a set of concepts through which they understand the world, which are maybe kind of conservative leaning, and other people have a set of concepts through which they see the world, which are kind of liberal leaning. And yeah, again, if you match up two people with different concepts about how the world should operate, then that can be an interesting situation. So from our concepts, we get a kind of frame through which we see the world. We get a world view. And again, we can get quite bound up in that. Aggregate number four is sankhara. Fabrications, mental activity, something like that. And this is really a sort of everything else bucket for thoughts, emotions, intentions, memories, and so forth. There's a whole bunch of really interesting things in here. For one, there's the sense of volition, the sense of agency, our ability to make choices. And there's a couple of things wrapped up in here. There's intentions and there's impulses, right? Intentions we might think of as how we want to respond to something, how we might choose to respond to something. Impulses are more like just random ideas that wander into our head to see if we agree with them, to see if we want to act on them. And this ability to make choices is really quite central to our sense of who we are. There's memories, the story of who I've been, of where I've come from, the lessons I've learned, the background I've had, all that kind of stuff. Thoughts and emotions, the way I relate to the world, inclinations, impulses, responses, the way we respond to things. We might extrapolate from that and talk about something like character or personality. What kind of person are you? Are you an angry kind of person? Are you a patient kind of person? A compassionate kind of person? A thoughtful kind of person? And if there are particular ways that you typically make choices, or if there are particular types of choices you make, if there are particular impulses you commonly act on, then again, this can form part of our sense of who we are. Because our sense of who we are is really just kind of a line that's drawn through a bunch of dots picked out from random moments of our existence in an attempt to make sense of it. The fifth aggregate is vijnana, and this is consciousness. And another way of saying that is that it's about knowing. It's about what we're aware of. So here's an example. What I have here, maybe you can just about see that. This is a packet of tissues, right? You can see the packet of tissues, at least if you're looking at the screen, which means that you are conscious of my packet of tissues. Now let me put them down there. You no longer have eye consciousness relating to the packet of tissues. You can't see them anymore. I've hidden them. But it was only a couple of moments ago and I'm still talking about them. So you still remember that I have a packet of tissues. So you still have mind consciousness of the packet of tissues. The eye consciousness has ceased, but the mind consciousness is still there. And then at some point in a few minutes, your mind will wander, or you'll forget that I had them, or we'll start doing something else. And then you won't be conscious of the tissues at all, because now you'll be focused on something else. So this quality of knowing is perhaps one of the key features that distinguishes life from non-life, right? At least most people don't think of something like a rock as being particularly conscious, whereas something like a sheep is at least a little bit conscious, and a person is probably a little bit more conscious, hopefully, depending on the person. Some people seem to be more conscious than others. And different people seem to be conscious of different things. Some people, for example, are detail-oriented. They're much more conscious of little tiny nitpicky details, whereas other people are more big picture thinkers. They're much more conscious of the overall spread of what's going on and less attentive to the individual particulars. And then some people, as far as I can tell, are just pretty oblivious most of the time. I'm probably doing them a disservice, but again, that's certainly how it seems to me. So, what kind of person are you? How does your consciousness manifest itself? Is that something that you see as being part of who you are? So, just before we start the contemplation, I'll recap the five aggregates again, and I'll do it using a nice little I don't know what you'd call it, a nice little device that I pinched from Bhikkhu Anālya, who puts it in his book on the, I think it's a Satipatthana book where it shows up. But it's an easy way of remembering the five aggregates. So you're walking down the street on a hot sunny day, kind of tired, kind of sweaty, and then you encounter a tall, solid, pleasant, shady tree for lying under that you can see. Rupa, materiality, it's tall, it's solid. Vedana, it's pleasant. Sanya, it's a shady tree. You know what it is, you recognize it. Sankhara, what's coming up in response, how I might relate to it. Well, it's for lying under. It's a hot day and it's a shady tree. I can lie under it. That's something I could do with this object. And of course, it's a tall, solid, etc. tree that I can see. That's the consciousness part. So, are there any questions about the... Let me rephrase that. Are there any brief questions about the specific definitions of the five aggregates that I'm planning to use before we go into the contemplation? Because we can talk about the aggregates all night. I just want to make sure that nobody's sitting there thinking, I have no idea what the heck that third one was, because, yeah, we'll be working with these... this definition of the aggregates as we go into the contemplation. So if people could put their Zoom hands up if they have questions, and if not, then we'll go straight into the contemplation. All right, it's looking pretty good, so let's move into some contemplation territory now. So we'll begin with a few minutes of meditation just to settle the body, settle the mind, get ourselves into a space where we can really more fully apply ourselves to the contemplation. So setting yourself up in whatever posture you use and maybe putting the attention on the breath or doing some metta or whatever other practice you might use to settle the mind. We'll do that for about 5 or 6 minutes, and then I'll start the contemplation instructions. Now moving into the contemplation. First aggregate. Notice that you have a body with various qualities and capabilities. If you had a different body, would you be a different person? Notice that your body's qualities and capabilities change over time due to age, exercise, injury, and so on. Is your body a reliable source of pleasure? And could it ever be? Does your body always do what you want it to? Does it ever let you down? second aggregate. Notice that you experience things as pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. And that over time you learn your preferences in this regard. If you had different preferences, would you be a different person? Notice that your likes and dislikes change over time. Things which used to be unpleasant can become pleasant, and vice versa. Are your preferences a reliable source of pleasure? Could they ever be? Can you choose only to have pleasant experiences all the time? Moving on to the third aggregate. Notice that you understand the world through concepts, which you've learnt and developed over the course of your life, forming your worldview in your sense of what things mean. If you had a different worldview, would you be a different person? Notice that your concepts change over time. As you have new experiences, you learn new concepts, and over time you forget old ones. Are your concepts a reliable source of pleasure? Could they ever be? Can you control which concepts you pick up from your environment? Can you choose to forget an unwanted concept? fourth aggregate. Notice that you have various intentions, impulses, thoughts, emotions, memories, reactions. And over time, you learn to identify your character traits and your life story in terms of these. If you had different character traits or a different life story, would you be a different person? Notice that your habitual mental activities change over time. For example, in meditation, we cultivate compassion so that our instinctive responses become more compassionate. Are your mental activities a reliable source of pleasure? Could they ever be? Can you control what mental activities arise within you? Do you always act on the impulses and intentions that you approve of? Do you always refrain from acting on the impulses and intentions that you don't approve of? Fifth aggregate. Notice that you're conscious of all sorts of events throughout the day. If you had very little consciousness, or none at all, would you be a different person? Notice that your degree of consciousness changes over time. Sometimes you're very perceptive, sometimes absent-minded, sometimes asleep, unconscious. Is your consciousness a reliable source of pleasure? Could it ever be? Can you always choose what you become conscious of? And then just for the last few minutes, coming back to your meditation, allowing the thoughts that have been kicked up by the contemplation to settle down and integrate.